Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. Back in the winter of 2017, I sat in front of a fireplace visiting with a friend.
My name is S.E. Zahedi. I live in Port Huon, upstate New York. And I'm originally from Iran.
I've known S.E. for a few years. Actually, I'm better friends with his wife, Katie, who is principal at the middle school where my son attended. Katie is warm and bubbly and really outgoing. S.E. is also very warm, but he's much more shy and reserved. With his wife being so effervescent, he can kind of blend into the background. But I always suspected that he had an interesting story, and I was hoping that I could get him to tell it to me.
You're originally from Iran. Were you there during the revolution?
Yes. My position was against the revolution because it was like a so-called religious revolution. And when I saw clerics, we called mullahs, standing on the top of minibuses and then with a loudspeaker, they were leading the crowd to chant, "Death to America, death to the Shah." And I felt that this is not supposed to be a religious revolution.
Why didn't it seem religious to you?
Because religion is not supposed to want the killing of or death of other people. The religion before the revolution in Iran was a personal religion. Like the stories that we heard when I was growing up was the Prophet Muhammad. All the story we heard about forgiveness, love, and kind of a gentle religion. But when Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, came as a leader of revolution, he was saying actually Islam is political. Then you can use any means, any violence. And that was not what I believed or I knew Islam.
Initially, after Khomeini took over, there was a bit of springtime in Iran, some wiggle room in terms of civil liberties. And Essie was able to voice his opinion through writing.
For 1 year after the change, there were a lot of freedom. That's the time that I worked on publication because anybody could publish anything.
Essie published two books during the revolution's afterglow. One was on the commonalities of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and it was actually pretty well received. The other was an anti-communist translation, which angered some on the political left.
There was a communist party supported by Soviet Union, and they reported to the government that I was a CIA agent, and the Islam was I was introducing was American Islam. I was arrested. They stormed my home in the middle of the night. They took everything from my home. Based on the report that they received, they said that this person is going to be executed.
This person, you were going to be executed?
Yes. They were saying that you were going to be executed. But I didn't believe that because I knew I didn't do anything. I was not a CIA agent. I didn't do anything wrong.
From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them. It's the podcast where we tell stories from America's cultural divides. I'm Trey Kay. I don't know about you, but I didn't think about Iran much until 1979. That's when a group of college students who supported the Iranian Revolution seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran
and held 53 American diplomats and citizens hostage.
At the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, it is now Tuesday morning. Islamic religious leaders and Tehran radio...
I remember Ted Koppel on TV giving a daily update of what was happening. The whole thing played out over 444 days. Talk about a foreign government having a hand in a U.S. election. The whole ordeal dogged Jimmy Carter's re-election bid. And Iran released the hostages the very hour Ronald Reagan was sworn in as president.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
The Algerian aircraft carrying the hostages have left Tehran. The American hostages finally are on their way.
Ever since then, there's been an us-and-them relationship between America and Iran that has ebbed and flowed up through today. More recently, President Obama took a keep-your-friends-close and your-enemies-closer kind of approach, joining the European Union, China, and Russia to try to avoid a dangerous scenario.
The United States, together with our allies and partners, has reached a historic understanding with Iran, which, if fully implemented, will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon. As president and commander-in-chief, I have no greater responsibility than the security of the American people. And I am convinced that if this framework leads to a final comprehensive deal, it will make our country, our allies, and our world safer.
President Trump made it clear he is far less trusting. Not long after he was inaugurated, he issued an executive order barring immigration from 7 countries, including Iran. Iranian officials countered by barring Americans from entering their country. And earlier this month, President Trump made good on a promise that he hammered again and again during the 2016 presidential campaign and pulled out of that multinational deal.
The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. In just a short period of time, the world's leading state sponsor of terror will be on the cusp of acquiring the world's most dangerous weapons. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
In the days leading up to the president's announcement, I thought a lot about my friend Essie and his family, and how knowing them has given me a more nuanced understanding of Iranian people. Certainly there have been actions by the Iranian government over the past 40 years that should concern all Americans. But the way President Trump speaks about Iran reduces the majority of the people in that nation to scary boogeyman caricatures. Knowing Essie, I understand that the story is much more complex. So today, in the wake of the U.S. scrapping the Iran nuclear deal, we thought it might be nice to revisit an Iranian us-and-them love story that we produced last year. We call it Love, the Ayatollah, and Revolution. My friend Essie, short for Esach, a derivation of Isaac, was born in Shahsavar, Iran in 1942. Starting back in 1977, he witnessed the transformation of Iran into the Islamic Republic of Iran.
In the beginning of so-called revolution, there was no talk of overthrowing the regime. When it started, there was some political oppression by the government, the Shah. But socially, there were a lot of freedom. People could do anything, and you know, even you could criticize the government, but not the Shah himself.
So in case you're confused or don't know much about the history of Iran, it was a monarchy led by a Shah, Persian for king. Shah Reza Pahlavi had ruled since 1941. He was mostly secular and succeeded in modernizing Iran through economic and social reforms. He was also considered one of America's closest allies in the region. At a 1977 state dinner in Tehran, President Jimmy Carter toasted the Shah.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world.
Though it might have seemed tranquil from Carter's perspective, the Shah's regime was increasingly unpopular.
When I was in college, there were a lot of abuse of power by the Shah's regime. Any kind of protest by the student or intellectuals, then this SAVAK, which was the secret service of the Shah, got involved and oppressed. Everything was considered political. Even you had objection against the quality of food in cafeteria. Then the police SAVAK got involved.
SAVAK was the Shah's secret police and were notorious for imprisoning and torturing the Shah's political opponents. Essie says SAVAK's abuses on the public were among several factors that led to the revolution. Another factor was the Grand Ayatollah Khomeini, whom the Shah had exiled in 1964. Khomeini was living in Paris and continued to condemn the Shah's regime.
The Iranian students in America and also in Europe, they were supporting Khomeini based on his promises in Paris that he's not going to become a leader in Iran. He's not going to get involved with the politics or ruling the country.
Once the Shah had fled Iran, Khomeini was free to return home. He pledged that he would act as a guide to the politicians. After all, he was a cleric, not a statesman. But in February 1979, Khomeini disembarked from an Air France 747 and set foot on his homeland. The revolution was still evolving, both in terms of who would run the country and how much freedom it would have. The Ayatollah and his clerics began framing an Islamic constitution, which informed nearly every aspect of life in Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini was now the supreme leader and would no longer tolerate dissent in the name of freedom. Here he is in August 1979, delivering a message which seemed to be aimed at my friend Essie.
Our writers are either ignorant or traitors. These so-called Democrats who say the country should be free and you should under no circumstance restrict any freedoms, they are inspired by superpowers and want to plunder us and want our youths to be indifferent. We want to protect the country, and protecting the country is impossible with the freedoms you talk about. These freedoms will destroy the country.
Despite this new crackdown on the press, Essie was miraculously released from prison, narrowly avoiding execution for his publications. He literally felt like he dodged a bullet. But was he a marked man?
I had some friends within the government who informed me that extremists, those people who are more revolutionary, more aggressive, are going after all those people they think that are potentially counter-revolutionary. So they may come after you. So that's why I got the signal that I should leave the country.
But let's dial back a few years. Just before all of this turmoil in Iran unraveled, Essie Zahedi went to New York City. And that's when he met Katie Jensen, originally from Bloomington, Minnesota. They were introduced by a mutual friend, and they seemed to have an instant, almost telepathic connection. Later, with Katie still in New York and Essie back in Tehran, they communicated via letters, using a system of codes and aliases designed to evade Iranian authorities.
So I'd walk into the post office and I'd see the letter with the stamps from Iran. This was pre-email. And there'd be these pictures of him standing in front of the rocks with, like, you know, a bunch of other guys or something. And, I just really felt for him at some point.
During a time when written correspondence took weeks to arrive, Iran was convulsing minute by minute. There was no playbook for what was happening in Iran. The former U.S. ally was now being run by a cadre of clerics more comfortable debating Quranic passages than foreign policy. And all the while, Katie kept writing to Essie, and he'd reply if he wasn't in prison.
I'd hear from him usually once every week or two. Unless he was in prison, then I'd worry.
Well, this is around the time that they're thinking that you're an American spy,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, it was then during the revolution, and she had to adopt a Sunni name called Benafshe.
Benafshe.
Benafshe, which is violet in English. That is the name of the flower.
Why did you need this name?
You write Katie Jensen on the envelope.
Yeah, and we didn't want to show that I'm corresponding with some foreigner.
If it says on the envelope Benafshe Zahedi, then they'll think, oh, this is a cousin living in the U.S.
Oh, and did it say Zahedi?
Yeah, I wrote Benafshe Zahedi on it.
You had this name and then his last name. You'd only met each other once, but in a way, through correspondence, you were already married.
You know, it wasn't what was said. It was more what wasn't said. Some things are just like they're real, and maybe you need to take some time and convince yourself of something. But I didn't need that. I just, like, yeah, I'm probably going to marry him.
Having made the decision to leave Iran, Essie needed to let Katie know.
We communicated through some kind of like a sign and said that you're sending your package to Pakistan.
So that was a code?
Like a code, yes.
So you wrote her and said, I'm sending your package to Pakistan, and that's how she knew that's where you're going?
Yes.
Essie's decision to flee Iran meant that he would have to leave his parents and siblings behind, possibly putting them in danger from retaliation by Iranian authorities. But he could wait no longer. He took a bus to eastern Iran and planned to cross the border into Pakistan. Essie's escape took all kinds of fantastic twists and dangerous turns. Some were so sharp you wonder how he made it out at all.
I traveled to the eastern city of Zahedan, near Pakistan. From there, I planned to find some human smugglers. And then this person actually brought me to the border where the border guards, they were waiting. And I was almost arrested. So I had to hide so they couldn't find me. And then I had to walk for a couple of days through the desert.
Did you have food?
I didn't have any food. I had just a few oranges.
How many oranges did you have?
I had 3 oranges.
Essie had gotten lost. After 2 days of walking around in the desert with no water, he was still inside Iran. Luckily, he found a Pakistani man to help him out.
He had a pickup truck. I sat in the middle, and then his cousin, and he drove for, I think, for 2-3 hours through all these hills and desert. And then it was like 11 o'clock at night, and that he said, now we are inside Pakistan. So from now on, you are by yourself. We have to find your way.
Essie knew that he had to save some money for a train ticket to the Pakistani capital. So he gave the smuggler as much as he could, but also his wristwatch as payment. There in the middle of nowhere, the smuggler pointed Essie to the next destination.
When he stopped, it was at night, about 11 o'clock. He put me on the spot and said, if you walk through this track, in half hour you will get to a village. And then in that village, you can ask for help.
But could you see the path?
I could see with the path. Actually, the moon came up, so it was light. So I got to the top of the hill, and I saw the lights at this little village. From the top of the hill, I decided, so okay, that's the light I go. This light was the light of this mayor.
The mayor of the little village?
Yes. He's a little ordinary man, and he was poor, and it was not like the house. It was like 3 walls and the curtain instead of the 4th wall. And the old man was sitting with a young boy with a fire inside burning, and had the ticketer, and I just said, do you accept any guests? And then I said, yeah, well, he's welcome, and you're my guest.
Coming up?
He was in shock, honestly, because of his crossing, worried about his family, worried about his sisters, and all that he left behind.
I'm Trey Kay, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
Music lifts us up and brings us together, even when we can't get together in person. Mountain Stage brings you live performances on the air, online, and in our podcast. They remind you how it feels to be in a live audience listening to live music. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find a link to our stations and our podcast online at mountainstage.org.
When we left Essie, the mayor had given him a blanket and led him to a mosque to spend the night. The following day, Essie crammed into the back of a pickup truck for a journey lasting more than 24 hours, with multiple military checkpoints along the way. Luckily, the mayor had outfitted Essie in a traditional hat and robe so that he could blend in with the other merchants making the journey. As Essie was inching his way across Pakistan, Katie was making arrangements to fly to Islamabad to meet up with him.
I knew he left Tehran. I knew he was on his way, and I knew anything could happen.
Now, it's important to remember that Essie was attempting to get across Pakistan without any authorized paperwork. He's got a passport, but it wasn't stamped at the border. His visa is forged, he doesn't have a birth certificate, and he only has enough money for a train ticket.
When you're near the border, they'll check you. So he's standing there. He doesn't have an exit visa from Iran, nor does he have any stamp that he's legally in Pakistan. So he's waiting in line, and they're checking, as they do. And he's just walking up the line and wondering what's going to happen.
The guard at the checkpoint, who could have detained Essie and maybe subjected him to some extreme vetting, got called away for the moment. This gave Essie a chance to purchase a ticket without showing any identification and then move on his way. I mean, to me, the level of suspense resembled the scene in Casablanca, where Ilsa eluded the Nazis by getting on the plane and flying away just in the nick of time. I mean, here's looking at you, kid.
So a lot of strange things happened. Synchronicity. Strange things. But these things now that seem so fantastic to us were really small because the whole shock of what he was going through at the time and his real concerns about safety for his family were the real thing. It wasn't that, oh, aren't we lucky and isn't this fantastic?
Although he seemed to walk a blessed path, Essie knew that everything could come crashing down at any moment. Any stranger's kindness, strokes of luck, or cosmic intervention couldn't shake his constant worry about his family back in Tehran. He knew that his fleeing the country had certainly put his loved ones at risk. Once Essie was safely in Islamabad, Katie was on the next flight to Pakistan.
It was raining that day. Rarely rains in Islamabad. It rained the day I arrived and the day I left. There wasn't any feeling like I just met you. I felt like I'd been looking into that face for 40 years. That's how I felt. And he was in shock, honestly, because of his crossing, worried about his family, worried about his sisters and all of that, all that he left behind.
I felt good that she's there to help me, but I was very unsettled. All this time I was worried, you know. I didn't have so much time, maybe the effect of what happened in Iran and also on my journey to Pakistan, but then at the same time worried that I may be stopped at one point. Feeling was not kind of relaxed.
And he didn't tell me that, but I didn't have a shred of a doubt. I knew everything was totally fine. And I just walked out in this crowd and he grabbed my hand and we just, you know, went and we would walk all day and just, for example, these little green Afghani raisins. We'd buy a bag and we'd walk for hours all over Islamabad, Rawalpindi. He'd just clean a few off because they're not completely clean. Hand it to me like I'm a bird or something. I thought that was the most surprising thing. Like, what do you think I am, a bird? He'd clean off these raisins and give me a few and we'd walk in silence. He felt it was going to be impossible to get a visa. But I was sure we'd get what we want, and he didn't have any legal document. And so we went into the embassy. There'd been people who'd been waiting there for a long time that knew each other well, and if we were interviewed, we had never even had a formal date. So we had met each other and written to each other. But the guy behind the counter just looked at me, and he said, I'm going to help you. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, good. I didn't realize that was uncommon. I was 22, Essie was 32. I didn't realize these things. Then he said to Essie, do you have a birth certificate? He said, no. He said, okay, do you swear that you were born in Shah Savar, Iran, November 27th, 1947? And Essie said, yes. He said, okay, here's your birth certificate.
As far as Katie and Essie were concerned, they were engaged. but it would be a lot easier to get into the U.S. if they had a marriage certificate.
Katie's coming in with a photo album. Oh, my goodness.
I just wanted to show you this. Let's see. The picture, we got married in Pakistan, Islamic marriage, so I had a veil. And we just picked some people off the street as our witnesses, and because we didn't know anybody. And so it was just a few people in a crummy little office in Rawalpindi with a little veil, a little blue veil.
So describe this photograph here for me, Essie.
Yeah, it was an office of the Pakistani mullah who officiate the wedding ceremony. And this is a kind of like a procedure. He reads some verses of the Quran, and then he asks questions from me and Katie. And then after that, he said, oh, now you can exchange rings. That's the time that we exchange rings.
So this is you right here?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
And we had to make the in Urdu, we had to make the wedding certificate. And so what for the dowry, the man gives a dowry. And I said, well, I'd like 40 camels. We were joking back and forth. Then the mullah says to us, do you give your husband the right to divorce you? I said, yes. Then he looked at him. He says, do you give your wife, now this is a legal document, do you give your wife the right to divorce you? He said, no. I thought, whatever. So we just signed it. I can show you it. It's very funny. It's all in Urdu. Neither one of us can read it.
And, well, did you ever collect on the camels?
No, I have to divorce him to get it. I don't know what did we actually ended up putting in it. Did we put some sheep or camels or something?
No, a Quran.
Oh, he reduced it. So I was talking about camels. He said, let's just make a Quran the dowry. So if we do get divorced, he has to give me a Quran, which I have right over there on the piano.
Fortunately, Essie and Katie have these old photos from their whirlwind courtship and wedding in Pakistan. But sadly, their collection of love letters were damaged in a flood years later. Unlike Essie and Katie, Iran and the United States have had a complicated love story. Over the years, both countries have flirted, given each other the silent treatment, rendezvoused on weapon-dealing trysts, passed notes through back channels, and publicly denounced each other in terms so nasty, it reads like a messy tabloid tell-all. But that's how the regimes coexisted. What about the salt-of-the-earth Iranians and everyday Americans? Are we really as divided as we're directed to be? Whether love will keep us together or love will tear us apart, Essie and Katie give us hope that Americans have more in common with Iranians than our leaders would have us believe. Katie and Essie invited me into their home and shared their story with me. Over the course of the evening, we played backgammon, sipped chai, listened to classic Persian ballads, and enjoyed a mouth-watering Persian dinner prepared by Katie. They also told me a story about a recent New Year's Eve gathering of their extended family and friends, first and second generation Iranian immigrants. Some were singing along to Persian folk songs, others to Earth, Wind, and Fire. But as Essie tells it, everyone cut loose on this anthem of sorts, a song that they all deeply love. Been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this episode was me, Trey Kay, Mitch Hanley, Lori Stern, Whitney Henry Lester, and Loretta Williams. Special thanks to Heidi Gavadel for helping with Iranian archives and translation, and the Leon Ensemble for use of their music, which you can find on our website at usandthempodcast.com. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed our theme music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasafi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide us with images for the web. The wonderful people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association for Independence in Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PBS.